Evi Bauer.
Valerie Gabel.
Robin Schmidt.
Alexandra Christoph.
Laura Garic.
Barbara Seemann.
Christian Jungwirth.
Jola Kovacevica.
Paul von Urfeld.
Georg Kuntner.
Matthias Seller.
Jakob Plattner.
Katharina Buschenreiter.
Susanne Löffig.
Edgar Ketzer.
Clemens Siegel.
Barbara Eppensteiner.
Anton Rinschan.
Melanie Schiller.
Senat Bergic.
Richard Herrmeier.
So, thank you so much to the whole team here at Octo 8, this amazing television station that runs Democracy Now! Every day in Vienna. That does it for our broadcast. Also, special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. I'll be speaking in Vienna and Graz. Visit our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Today is Friday, October 24th, 2014. And we're joined in the studio with our special guest for today, continuing our series of interviews with candidates who will be on the November 4th election ballot. And, you know, since we only have an hour a week and we don't want to do sound bites, that would be well, it's what everybody else does. You know, we'd like to have the chance to have a few extra minutes to talk to some of these candidates. So we're not doing the incumbents, just challengers, in case you hadn't been following. And so no disrespect to the incumbents. But if you don't know who they are and what they're all about by now, then, you know, you're not reading the papers, I guess, or you're not keeping up with friends in the community. So they've had their chance. And of course, there's all kinds of flyers going out and there's stories in the newspapers. I do want to commend the Press and Guide in terms of this race that Tony Guerrero is going to be here and talk to us about his candidacy. The incumbent, Mark Sommer, was extensively profiled and had a chance to answer questions in a similar way a week or so ago in the Press and Guide. And this was really good, really nice. You get a very good idea. In fact, it goes two pages. In fact, not one, but two. Well, in a little bit of the second page. And this is from last Sunday, October 19th, pages A6 and A7. But I'm not going to refer to those because Tony Guerrero is right here with us. So welcome to the WHFR Journal, Tony.
Thank you, Jay. And okay. Thank your listeners.
Well, you know, your picture has been out in the papers for months, so they certainly should know what you look like. And that's good, you know, face name recognition. But in fact, you've been here in Dearborn as a magistrate from 93 to 2003, about 10 years, in the 19th District Court. Tell us about that experience. Obviously, you're a lawyer, you went to law school, even went here to Henry Ford Community College?
Yes. I'm a very proud alumnus of
there
Henry
you go.
Ford Community College, now known as Henry Ford College.
That's right.
And I will tell you, I have a face made for radio, so we're in perfect spots.
I don't think so. By the way, we share the same barber.
I'll be
the same stylist, yes. Don't want to give any plugs here necessarily, but good haircut, so is mine, so there you go.
Let me tell you, as a magistrate in the district court, that was one of the best experiences that I could have as an attorney and in training for being a judge. For those of you who don't know, the magistrates are what I would call one step below the judge. The magistrates have limited powers. Primarily the magistrates in our district court, in the 19th district court, would preside over arraignments, warrant recalls, civil infractions, commonly known as traffic tickets, and small claims cases, among other things. But it is limited power that's given to you by appointment of the chief judge of the 19th district court.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing about it is you actually are conducting court and you're dealing with people who are coming into the court, in most cases, for the first time. And it's really gratifying being a magistrate because you're dealing with people one-on-one and you're not necessarily dealing with attorneys. You know, in small claims, attorneys are not allowed. So you get, you as the magistrate, get to interact with the litigants, the people who are suing in a small claims case, and you don't have the attorneys involved to make whatever arguments are being made.
It's not like the TV shows like Judge Judy or whatever, though, because they're not real courts.
Well, you know, it's not like Judge Judy, although I'll tell you, there are moments where you really do have some of those experiences where people get very, very animated.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I will tell you, and is very, very good for me as a magistrate and as a former judge, when people come into the court, they're generally their first experience and they're generally terrified. You know, I found that it was really helpful to explain to people what the procedure was and make sure that they understood their rights and they understood exactly how we were going to conduct the trial. You know, in other words, okay, you're the plaintiff, you're the one who's suing, you say your piece first, then the defendant, the one who's being sued, gets to say their piece, and then there may be rebuttal back and forth. But you have to kind of referee between the two.
Okay, so the magistrates, I mean, somebody might say, well, why don't we just have more judges in the 19th District Court to handle these extra cases? The magistrates do somewhat quicker, or you might say smaller cases? I wouldn't say lesser cases, because they're all important, but...
No, the volume in the 19th District Court is rather high, so...
One of the highest in the state, I believe, for district courts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So when you're dealing with the volume of traffic tickets that we have, you know, it's important for the magistrates to be there. Otherwise, the judges would be there all day, all night, trying to move that particular portion of the docket. And also, the statutes provide for the magistrates to conduct the informal hearings on traffic tickets. Now, if you'll allow me, I'll explain quickly.
Well, I'd be interested. First of all, the magistrates are appointed?
That's correct.
By the
chief judge.
Chief judge, okay.
Now, traffic tickets, you have two different kinds of hearings. You can have an informal hearing, or you can have a formal hearing. A formal hearing is where it's the individual and perhaps their attorney and the prosecuting attorney, who would be one of the city attorneys for the city of Dearborn, or maybe the prosecutor from Wayne County. But that is the level where attorneys are involved. On the informal hearings, if you or I just get a traffic ticket and we want to contest it, and we don't want to have to hire an attorney, you can ask for an informal hearing. And the informal hearing is conducted by the magistrate, and it is simply the person who's accused of the traffic violation and the police officer. So the magistrate will conduct an actual hearing. It's a full-blown trial on what happens on that traffic ticket, and then make a determination on whether the person is responsible or not responsible.
I see. How many magistrates do we have right now in Dearborn?
We have three.
Three, okay. And we have three judges.
Correct.
And, of course, one of them is the chief judge, who is sort of the administrator for the operation of the district court, and they're selected by people in the state of Michigan.
The chief judge is appointed every 2 years by the Supreme Court.
Supreme Court of the U.S.
Correct.
I mean,
no,
of the
Supreme
Michigan.
Court of the state of Michigan.
Yes, I got
it.
Of course. And yet, their budget comes from the city of Dearborn for the whole 19th District Court.
The funding, we call it the funding unit.
The funding unit.
Every district court, we're fortunate because we have a district court that is merely one funding unit, one city. There are other ones like the 34th District Court in Romulus, the 33rd District Court in Woodhaven, where there are multiple funding units. You may have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 communities all combined in one court.
I see. Okay. Well, let's talk about because if you are elected to be a judge in the 19th District Court in November, there seems to be some conflicts between and I know you have a lot of support from many of the members of Dearborn City Council endorsements, as well as Mayor O'Reilly's, which came out in a flyer that at least came to my house, I know. But it seems that I remember about 2 years ago, certain members, anyway, the city council, boards in the city council as a whole, said that we don't need as many judges. We only need two. We don't need three full-time people. And it seems, as you mentioned, the court, the caseload is so high, and it's appropriate to have the full, you might say, the full judges, depending on how many, let's say, what important cases are needed. You can't just do all magistrates and have one judge over them, can you? That doesn't really work.
No, there's an old maxim that says, justice delayed is justice denied.
Hear, hear. Yeah.
Here in our court, and not only in our court, but in all the courts in the state of Michigan, the State Court Administrator's Office, commonly known as SCAO, S-C-A-O, they do studies, and they've done a study to determine how many judges are necessary in each court. Mm-hmm. Our court is a very busy one, and it does warrant three judges.
Okay, so obviously you wouldn't run for the third position if you didn't think there was actually a need for a third judge. But the city council also, and again, you have many endorsements from many of them, as well as the mayor, they've said, you got to make more money here. You got to raise the fines. How do you feel about raising the fines for people who are found guilty of some infraction?
Well, I look at things a little differently. I think that the system where the cities have to fund the court is not one that I would advocate. Mm-hmm. I think that we should be one unified court of justice, and I believe that the courts really should be run by the state, in my view. Mm-hmm. And the commentary that's being made about raising the fines and so on, let me just answer that in this fashion.
Sure.
The problem isn't there. The problem is that when you have a traffic ticket that's adjudicated, somebody comes in, they pay their ticket, or they're found responsible, the fine is levied. That fine goes in many parts. There's a big portion that goes to the state. There's another portion that goes to this fund, to that fund. There's really a small amount of that traffic ticket fine that really stays locally with the court.
Really? I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. And truly, you know, most people don't know that. But when you really start breaking it down, most of that money goes to the state and not to the local municipality.
Of course, we know budgets are tight for every city.
Sure.
Some are on the edge of bankruptcy, some are still in it under emergency financial manager, and so I can understand how some city council members would be looking everywhere they could for additional funds. But it seems like, yes, the court system should have somewhat firm footing. If I can just veer off to, we mentioned the state Supreme Court briefly as the people that appoint the Chief Justice, and there's people coming up for election there on the ballot. In fact, Craig Foran this week had a great op-ed piece in the Press and Guide about how do you choose judges for the Supreme Court. But in Michigan, it's partisan. There's Republicans and there's Democrats. I don't really know if that's so good an idea. Obviously, it helps them run for election because there they are on the, you know, the ballot along with the other Republicans or the Democrats. I'd like to believe that justice not is blind. It can't be blind to the circumstances and the situations in our society, but I don't know. I'd like to see a different way of getting judges elected in Michigan. Obviously, if it was all partisans, they would still go hat in hand to one party or another for contributions.
It's interesting because I just had this come up as I was going door to door yesterday. Mm. And the question was posed exactly as you said. Mm-hmm. You know, why do we have political parties nominate the Supreme Court? And, you know, what political party are you asking me? And I had to explain to the young lady that the nominations for Supreme Court do come from the parties, from the Democratic Party and from the Republican Party, even though the candidates for Supreme Court justice are on the ballot as nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. When you get down to our level, and I say the district court, mm-hmm. the circuit court and the district court are not candidates for judicial positions there are not nominated by the parties. For instance, in the city of Dearborn, in order for me to get on the ballot, I had to obtain a requisite number of signatures on a petition in order to be placed on the ballot.
Sure.
But it is a rather strange system where, as far as the Supreme Court goes, they're nominated by the parties, even though they're a nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. They're nonpartisan on the ballot.
And even at the U.S. Supreme Court level, where it's appointments by consultation with the Senate from the president with approval by the Senate, there's still a lot of partisanship there about if it's a president of one party, then generally they can get somebody that they like more than the opposing party. But it doesn't always work out that way. And of course, there's been a lot of delays in the appointments of some judges. But I think that the separation of these branches is extremely important.
Absolutely. The independence of each branch of government is extremely important, especially the courts.
Is it a problem then for you that you have so many friends and supporters from the city council and the mayor in trying to do your job in the future? Or it shouldn't really have anything to do with it?
Not in the least.
You can't give them a Hail Mary on a parking ticket or something.
No.
I mean, that's...
Anyone who knows me knows that I am as straight as the day is long. And when it comes down to a decision that comes before the court, my personal beliefs, my friendships, and so on do not have anything to do with it. I have to call the law as I see it. The job of a district judge and any judge is to listen to the parties, determine the facts, and then apply the facts to the law, no matter what the outcome. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter who's before you. Everyone deserves to be treated the same way. They all should be treated fairly, and the decision should be made based upon the facts and the law.
You mentioned a lot of the things that the district court has to deal with, especially what the magistrates did. There's, of course, a variety of misdemeanors that go with to a judge, felony preliminary exams, something called show causes. Maybe tell me what that is briefly.
Show causes where someone has failed to comply with an order of the court.
Oh,
say,
okay.
Say someone has violated their probation, or someone is under an order to pay money, or they're under an order to perform community service or work program, and they failed to do that.
Okay, gotcha.
A show cause basically is an order issued by the court that says, you are to come before the court and show cause why you shouldn't be held in contempt.
And in my list here, which I actually got from the great interview from the Press and Guide, where you also detail these things, you talked about sentencing. Do you sometimes do jury cases, too, at the 19th District Court, or is it just decisions from the judge?
Oh, no. There are criminal cases. If they go to trial, you may have a jury trial, you may have a bench trial. And the difference, so that people understand the difference, the jury trial, the facts are determined by a jury of your peers, and that's people who are registered electors. That's people who are registered to vote in the city of Dearborn.
Is that 12 people these days, or is it less in some cases?
No, in the district court, it's 6 people with one alternate. Generally, we will pull 7 jurors and have 7 sit through the trial, just in case somebody gets sick or some emergency comes up. And then at the very end of the trial, the 7th one will be randomly drawn off. They're allowed to stay if they want to stay and watch the proceedings, but they won't participate in the jury's deliberations.
Hmm. I was called down to one of the Wayne County courts to be a juror about 6 months ago or 8 months ago, and boy, they went through like the whole group of us, like, what was it, 60
hundreds.
Or whatever, hundreds. So it was huge, and that took a long time. Finally, it turned out I was one selected, and then in the next 3 hours, and all kinds of things happen. It seems that the defense attorney somehow was caught talking to one of the witnesses in the hallway, so they called a mistrial, and we all went home. But I think it take more than a day to even select us? I think it did, and then we had to come back the next day, and then we didn't even get through with it. That's an arduous process. A lot of people don't realize how jury selection, and it may not be quite as bad at the district court level, or as You know, I can't think there were 12 of us for that court.
Yes, that would be on a felony. You'd be looking at
that. Right, it was a felony.
Many.
Sure. Yeah. I just think what I'm recommending to our listeners is sometime they ought to come and sit in on a court session if it's not closed. Usually they're open to the public.
They are all open to the public.
You learn an awful, well, of course it should be public, shouldn't it? But,
yes.
But it's a real learning experience and appreciation for what goes on and how the legal system is not the way it's paraded on television.
Not at all.
Where it's all showboating and quick answers, and you never see the extent of, in fact, the wheels of justice, which they do move somewhat slowly, but it has to be that way. It has to be methodical and to make sure that it's as fair as possible. So it's a noble profession to be a judge, certainly, and it's not easy because of the process.
It takes a great
deal. But the process is important.
Takes a great deal of patience.
Okay. Now, for a while, you weren't a judge. you significantly, although you went to the 23rd District in Allen Park, you were appointed by Governor Granholm.
24th.
24th. Okay. I got that number wrong. But that was just for a year. And then you got into being city attorney for a number of places, Westland and Plymouth Township, Melvindale, Hamtramck, Allen Park. First of all, were all those... is that a full-time position in each of the cities?
No.
It's a part-time. They call you in as a consultant, sort of.
Out of almost 35 years, I've served as a city attorney in five different communities for almost 30 years.
I see.
They're part-time positions where you're appointed by the, generally it's the mayor, or if it's a weak mayor form of government, it'll be by the council. In those positions were very, very helpful to me because obviously you learn all aspects of cases that come in the district court and the circuit court as well. As a city attorney, I would serve as the city's prosecutor. I would serve And I would serve as also a civil litigator for the city. I would be advisor to the mayor and the council, advisor to the zoning boards, the planning commissions, all of the
helping
the
to negotiate labor contracts too, or be part of the process?
No, I did negotiate the labor contracts as well, and that would be the labor contracts with the police, the fire, and the general employees who were usually
support
represented
staff,
by AFSCME.
Yes. Okay. Wow. So how can that be part-time? That seems like almost full. In Dearborn, Deborah Walling is full-time, but she has a staff of other people who may not be.
And she is... she is full-time because our charter provides for a full-time attorney and a full-time legal department. That's not the case in many other communities. Westland, Plymouth Township, Melvindale, Hamtramck, Allen Park. The city attorney is essentially a contract employee who comes in and charges on an hourly basis for the things that need to be done. Many cities find that it's much more cost-effective to utilize an experienced city council or city councilor in that fashion rather than having someone full-time with benefits, pension, and all the rest.
Yeah, it might just be a dollar sort of thing. I sort of think, in fact, being part of the telecom faculty here for many years, one of the topics within telecom is public relations, in fact. And it's finally dawned on most people, at least in the business world, even with the small business to medium-sized businesses, that they need a public relations person advice on a full-time basis, not just when there's a crisis. And it would seem to me that legally, for example, Deborah Walling, she sits in on, I think, pretty much every city council meeting. And if a question comes up, obviously, it's off the top of her head, but she can try to answer it, or she takes notes and says, "We'll get back to you within a week, or we'll get an update on that as soon as possible." So that's just very interesting. These other areas weren't full time. Allen Park, okay, you were there up to the bankruptcy, and it really wasn't a bankruptcy yet, was it? It was financial manager came in, but at what point were you?
Oh, I left at the end of 2010. In fact, I had tendered my resignation in mid-2010, but the city council and the mayor wouldn't accept my resignation, allow me to leave until the end of the year.
I see. Okay.
Was this... I wasn't there when the emergency financial manager was appointed.
Yeah, and of course, if people know, I just know a little bit about that law. The way the legislature and the governor have applied it is that a city doesn't necessarily have to be in bankruptcy officially for the state to come in and appoint that person and sort of take over the city.
That's correct.
Certainly, Allen Park had some difficulty because of the Unity Studios not following through on their contract. Although I have to say, as someone in telecom, I have a lot of friends in the what's left of the Michigan film industry. We didn't know who this guy was. we knew nothing about his credentials. We didn't think it was a very good idea, but we weren't called in. They even tried to set up a school for the first year. This is after you left before they got into film production. And we said, wait a minute, there's other schools around here, including Henry Ford College and Wayne State, and we teach film and filmmaking, and okay, maybe there's a special class just for the people who are the drivers and the caterers to understand the process. Oh, we can come up with that really quick. In other words, sure. We had the education. So there was a lot of things that didn't seem right. It's too bad that the mayor was misled on that, and you weren't involved in that directly, although maybe you had to look at a contract or two, but that's...
The interesting part about this that people don't understand is that the city council had voted to buy this property long before they ever heard about a studio.
Mm-hmm.
So they had made that decision well before they ever ran into the gentleman from Unity Studios.
Yeah.
The decision was made, and it's their decision. You know, the problem in all of this, and you may hear things back and forth, but... You know, the attorney is an advisor. The attorney doesn't have a vote. It's the city council and the mayor that have the vote on whether or not these things are going to be done. And it is unfortunate. When the city agreed to buy the property, then the Unity Studios gentleman came around, and everybody decided that they were going to turn Allen Park into Hollywood, but didn't work out that way.
I should say it's not just Allen Park's fault, it's a little bit because the incentive from the legislature changed. It was drastically reduced. Of course, we went through 2008. Money was tight again, and there was a decision to much lower. I think now it's almost totally been eliminated. A couple of rulings or a couple legislative decisions in the last couple of weeks, in fact, but again, those of us who were like kind of close to the film industry in Michigan, we've looked at other states, and if you're going to give incentive for something like the film industry, it takes that kind of support from the government maybe at least 5 years. I mean, large sums of money, if you can afford it, of course, in order for those new businesses to get set up, the new studios, the new producers, the new editing facilities, computer graphics, and to start getting some business in and start getting some advertising out there and start getting some names made. And then, as happened in other states like New Mexico and other places in the country, you can back off. You can back off then. But it just, there wasn't enough incentive money to long enough, I think, to hold it up. And of course, that was one of the reasons Unity Studios, but I think there was all kinds of other management issues there. But just because you were involved with that, some people bring this up, maybe, you know, but there's a lot to learn about the function of cities and, in fact, labor contracts, too. Now, at least you're not dealing with labor contracts directly in 19th District Court, because that can get contentious. But you probably have contentiousness in many ways in these courts. I mean, obviously, it's pro or con, you know, defense attorney, prosecuting attorney, back and forth. So,
sure.
So you're ready for that, huh?
Always have been.
Okay. Let me talk about a couple of specific cases. And they do this, I know, for people who were appointed by the president and being interviewed by the U.S. Senate on certain kinds of decisions they might make. And a lot of people, wisely these days, say, I want to look at the case. I'm not going to talk about what I might say until I see the actual situation. And I understand that. But in the history of Dearborn here, we have gone back and forth a number of rulings from 19th District Court about medical marijuana issues. And of course, it's illegal technically, I think, nationally. But many states have medical marijuana, like Michigan does, that is legal. Do you have to wait to see what comes before you? And something like that. It seems like in these situations where there's a conflict, I know some judges, local judges around the country, they said, federally. Federal government said it's wrong, so I'm going to say it's wrong, even though there was a state law also. So would you just look at it in terms of like the ordinance in Dearborn or the state? Or how?
I think you have to look at the law as a whole. You can't just cherry pick one portion out as opposed to another. But I will confess, there's a conflict. Obviously, we have a state statute that allows medical marijuana, and we have a federal law that says marijuana is prohibited. Now, it becomes a very delicate legal question because there is the concept of states' rights, and there is the concept of the supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution. So it is difficult to balance that.
But should a judge at the local level, the 19th district, be concerned about the federal level? Because if it's out of whack with the federal level, that case will eventually, although it'll take some time, get up into the federal legal system.
I believe that what you need to do is you need to look at the case that's before you. You know, as a district court judge, you're a state court judge, and if the charge before you is under Michigan law, then you have to look for guidance to Michigan law. If it was a federal violation, I, as a district court judge, wouldn't have the authority to hear it.
I see.
It would have to go to a federal judge.
You would just pass it along.
And while that may sound like a cop-out, the bottom line is no state court judge, district, circuit, court of appeals, or even Supreme Court in Michigan has authority over a federal statute. Those are strictly under the jurisdiction of the federal judges.
Yeah, I know in Michigan, just to sum this up, I think the state is thinking about tightening up their rules about licensing so that it doesn't become just any doctor on a street corner can start signing prescriptions, or somebody, if some doctor is a consultant sitting on a stool in the in the dispensary there, just signing their name. And I think Dearborn was even considering zoning these people, that they wanted to put these dispensaries only in certain locations, like maybe not next to a school, or I don't know. But there's still more to be said on that. Of course, some states have taken the bold step, and they just say it's legal for people over whatever 18, 21, like Colorado, and I don't know what the federal government does to them or what the judges do out there then.
Well, don't let me mislead your listeners. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a very common occurrence in the 19th District Court for someone to be charged with possession of marijuana and come forth with the defense that, well, I'm not guilty of possession. I have a medical marijuana card that's sanctioned by the state, and therefore I had a legal right to possess this marijuana. So that is faced on almost a daily basis in the 19th District Court.
I won't mention any names, but there are three other justices serving right now. One of them said to me that in the district courts, there's just a scourge of drug cases coming in. I mean, they thought it was a huge increase from whatever their comparison was a few years ago or a decade ago. Do you think that's true? Do you know those numbers? Or you don't have to know the numbers, but
I don't know the numbers, but I would agree that that's true. Part of the problem that we're seeing is that you're seeing marijuana cases, you're seeing many cases now involving abusive prescription drugs. We're seeing a lot of Vicodin. We're seeing a lot of cases involving Norco, which is a combination of Vicodin and acetaminophen, which is Tylenol. The ones that scare you to death are the ones that are coming in with cocaine and heroin. There's a rampant increase in the use of heroin, both by snorting and by injection.
And Dearborn has something. Is it called a drug court, or is there a separate way you organize these cases or hear them? I thought I heard something about a drug court, but
to my understanding, there isn't a formal drug court in Dearborn. There are a number of drug courts and sobriety courts throughout the throughout Wayne County in the various district courts. And a drug court is essentially a very, very intensive program where the drug offender will be given a plea bargain and be sentenced to the drug court program, where a judge actually supervises them. They meet with the probation on an intensive basis. They're required to attend an intensive outpatient program, and they're required they're required to drop urine on a regular basis in order to make sure that they're not using drugs. And then there is generally a once or twice a week, it's usually twice a week, where they meet with the district judge and review their progress. And my understanding as the program goes on is they're given a little more freedom as they demonstrate that they're making progress towards their total recovery and total sobriety. They get a little bit more freedom, a little bit more freedom as they go along.
Well, it seems like that's really appropriate counseling, because I mean, I'm aware of how addictive drugs can be and how hard it is to deal with it. But that's a massive, I'm sorry to say, bottom line expense, but counseling and especially trained people.
Truly, okay. But it's
so necessary. We don't need it yet in the 19th district, or if we do, it hasn't happened yet.
Well, I can tell you, most drug courts are funded by grants.
Oh,
and
that's nice.
the key, the judges who are involved in the drug courts will definitely go after the grants, because you need that funding that provides for the drug court and provides to defray those costs without putting a burden on the city of Dearborn and without putting an additional burden on the taxpayers.
Well, we've been talking to Tony Guerrero here for the last, much more than I said I would hold you. So last week I made Debbie Dingell late for a meeting in Grand Rapids. So I've got to be aware of the time allotted here. But it's great to talk to you about these issues. Let me just allow you to sum up. We found out a lot about your background, your experience, and how you feel about many of these issues that will face you here. I'm just going to give you, I hope it's fair, a couple of minutes. I'm not going to look at a clock, you know, and watch a second hand here, but no more than a minute or two to sum up why you should receive the vote for 19th District Judge in November 4th.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, I thank you, and I thank your listeners. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I decided to run for this position because I care about our city. I've been in this community for almost all of my life. You know, grew up in the South End and went to the East End and to the West End, and I've been educated here. I'm a graduate of Fortson High School. I'm a graduate of Henry Ford College, graduate of University of Michigan Dearborn, and graduate of Wayne State's Law School. You know, I'm one of those people that worked on the assembly line at Ford Motor Company while I was going to school. And what I bring to the bench is a number of things. I have the experience from having been a city attorney and served in all of these various capacities. And that sounds kind of self-serving, but I've been a prosecutor, I've been a defense attorney on the criminal side, I've been a plaintiff's attorney on the civil side, defense attorney on the civil side. I've been a magistrate, I've been a judge, I've been a mediator, an arbitrator, all of those things. And the great thing about it that I believe gives me a great perspective is I've worked on every side of the bench, including being behind the bench, and it has helped me to stay balanced. I don't get overly crazy about one position or the other. I'm able to see the side of the prosecutor and the side of the defendant. I'm able to see the side of the plaintiff and the side of the defendant in a civil case. Those things, coupled with growing up in the South End, which is the biggest melting pot in all of North America. I mean, when we grew up in the South End, we had every ethnic group that you could think of. We had Lebanese, we had Palestinians, we had Iraqis, we had Indians, we had Italians, Romanian, Polish, on and on and on. And the good thing about that is it exposed me as a very young man to diverse cultures and diverse customs. So you understand that when people come to you in the court, as the judge, you've got to make them feel comfortable, and you also have to be aware of the fact that they come from different backgrounds, especially people where English is a second language. Their home country may have a court system that is draconian and completely opposed to ours. We have the most wonderful court system in the world because you're innocent until proven guilty, you have all these rights, and it's incumbent on the judge to protect those rights. Many people that come to our court come from countries where you're guilty until proven innocent, and it's the judge's job to make them understand that they do have all of these wonderful rights. Those are the things that I think I can bring to the court. And I do believe that there are some strained relationships going on in the court, and I don't share those strained relationships. My job is to come in and work in a collegial manner with Judge Hultgren and Chief Judge Salome to get administrative decisions done in an efficient way and to make sure that we move the docket. The most important thing there is you want to move the court cases along and not delay justice. And with that, I thank you very, very much for the time.
Are you going to be appearing anywhere in the local area? I know, and I can't remember it right now, you have a website.
I do.
Yes.
It is www.guerreroforjudge.com.
Yeah, they didn't put that in the article, but okay. Guerreroforjudge.com, pretty direct way to check on that. Is there going to be any other place in the next week or two?
We do have a camp out and about. Well, I can tell you, most people will find me out and about knocking on their doors.
Well, that's always important.
That's where
yes.
I'm going to be. We do have a candidate forum scheduled at Oakman School this coming Tuesday.
Oh, okay.
And I'll be out at various events all over town, but mostly if people are looking for me, you'll find me knocking on the doors.
Well, it's been a pleasure hearing all the information, and we can never know enough about politics and our court system, I think, folks, and that's why we give the candidates a little more time to explain, and learned a lot today. So thank you very much, Tony Guerrero, candidate for 19th District Judge. Be sure to get out there and vote. We'll be back with more of the new WHFR Journal after this commentary from Jack Lessenberry about Ebola. So I know you're going to listen up, right? Here it comes.
I seldom laugh out loud at anything I read, but I did at a story in the Detroit News yesterday. The headline said, Snyder, Michigan has 1,000 isolation beds for Ebola. That's all the proof I needed that sure enough, we're all going to die. But before you put on your hazmat suit to walk the dog, I want to let you in on a little secret. We are indeed all going to die, but not of Ebola. I'm frightened of many things, but I'm not worried about Ebola in the least. If over-the-air gambling was legal, I'd happily bet anyone that nobody in Michigan is going to die of Ebola, ever. That is, unless they go to West Africa and come in contact with the bodily fluids of an infected person, and I'm not planning on that this weekend. However, there's something that is hazardous to our emotional and mental health, and that is the appearance of any frightening disease close to an election. There are some people who like to be scared, but in a tame sort of way. Now, I don't mean to make light of Ebola. It's a horrible disease that has killed thousands of people. The governor's oral response was actually more sensible than that headline indicated. What he said was, Ebola is hopefully a low-threat, low-risk problem in the state of Michigan, but it's a serious one. Now, it makes perfect sense to have a plan in place, just in case. But there's no hidden hospital with 1,000 beds for Ebola victims, nor is there a facility designated for the treatment of such patients. Here's where the number in that headline comes from. All the hospitals in Michigan put together have 1,000 isolation beds that could theoretically be used to treat Ebola patients, which pretty much means nothing. Wally Hopp, a professor and dean at the University of Michigan, has sensibly argued that the state ought to designate one facility to receive any patient who might carry the virus. But consider this. While highly dangerous and infectious, Ebola is not very contagious. You apparently have to come in direct contact with the bodily fluids of a human or animal that has it. We've had precisely 3 cases in this country and 1 death, that of a man who was infected in Liberia and then traveled here. Nevertheless, we have had irrational panic. Universities have been disinviting speakers who've been in Africa, in some cases months ago, even though this is clearly irrational behavior. Yes, we should take precautions against Ebola, but if you want to worry about danger and increasing deaths, consider this. According to Carol King, a researcher at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute, 26 more people died in one recent year because the legislature passed and Governor Snyder signed a bill repealing the motorcycle helmet law. And their unwillingness to pass any kind of sane gun control means Michigan has more than 1,000 shooting deaths a year. Those are real problems. Something could be done about them. However, it's a lot easier for our leaders to pretend they're saving us from Ebola.
This is the new WHFR Journal. Thank you for listening today. Remember, all opinions expressed on this show, whether it's mine or Tony Guerrero's or just now Jack Lessenberry's, are not necessarily those of anyone else here at Henry Ford College. And they don't tell us what to say, but we thank them for the right to try to be responsible in what we say in some way, at least, even though opinionated, perhaps, at times. And remember, we're not endorsing any candidate here either for the election. Want to tell you in terms of candidates, Tony mentioned there's a candidate forum he's going to be attending at Oakman School, I believe he said. I don't know the time, probably in the evening, early evening, next Tuesday. So I would say League of Women Voters, Dearborn, Dearborn Heights might know something about that. Or on his website, TonyGuerreroForJudge.com, or maybe GuerreroForJudge.com. Just search for that and you'll find it listed there. Always good to go to those. Next week on this show, you'll only hear my voice at the beginning and the end for a few seconds. How will I keep myself from saying more? Well, it is the candidate forum for all the candidates from September 30th for the Dearborn Board of Education. And remember, when you elect them for that, they also become the Board of Trustees of Henry Ford College. Okay, so try to keep that in mind when you're voting for these people. They have to be the final administrative board for both institutions, the Dearborn Public Schools and Henry Ford College. We're not the same. We have separate budgets and so on. And oh my gosh, you know, we need people that can understand K-12 and also higher education. Not easy. In fact, a lot of people, I think, running for it, they just think, well, I want to be involved with that elementary school or junior high or high school. And they don't realize there's a college out there, too, that they also have to be the final decision makers about on many issues that come to them for a vote. So, in any event, it's a big deal. And so we're doing what we can. Not all the candidates who are on the ballot got to the debate, but I think 10 of 11 are there. And with careful, judicious editing of the introduction and the conclusion by the moderator, and all due respect to the League of Women Voters moderator, these are the questions, and these will be the questions and the full responses, full questions and full responses from all the candidates. And so the editing we did not change any of the questions or any of the answers. And we think it would be very educational for you to take notes on it. It is available at Dearborn Public Schools website. I think it's dearbornschools.org. You can watch it there. I will say, and this is because I only have an hour, well, with the podcast, actually an hour and 3 minutes. For the sake of time, I speeded it up. Now, yes, but you won't notice it. It's an audio trick. I speeded it up 10%. So rather than watching it on the Dearborn Public Schools website or listening to it there, this will take you 10% less time to listen to next week's show, which will also be podcast, of course, and archived on our WHFR.fm website. So there's no... you know, if you can't listen next Friday from 1 to 2, you can catch it immediately after 2 p.m. next Friday from the website directly. I think, yes, it shows all the candidates speak more quickly and pause less than they would in real life. But sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. You want people to be smart enough and wise enough to speak quickly. And yet, in a way, you also value a person who pauses and thinks before they speak incorrectly. Well, this is just a little bit faster. But you won't notice it because there's a trick we can do with digital processing called pitch shift, and we just brought it down. They won't sound like chipmunks in a convention. You will probably not even notice it if I hadn't mentioned it, but I'm just saying it'll take a little bit less time because 10 candidates, I think they had at least 6 questions. They were all asked to give about a minute or so response to, as well as opening statements and summaries at the end. So it'll all be part of the journal next week. Also, to give a plug here for the November 7th show. So in 2 weeks from today, we're going to start with a visit with our theater director, George Popovich, and talk about Dinosaurus. There's a great story in, I think it's in the Times Herald this week. Is it Press and Guide? I'm looking at it now. Well, anyway, there'll be more stories about it. It's a 3D experience with live stage action too. And you wear these special 3D glasses, and they are selling tickets now here for the performances at the Adrie Auditorium. You can go to hfcc.edu and click on Dinosaurus link, and you can get full information about that. But George Popovich will be here in 2 weeks just for about the first 10 minutes or so to tell you some behind-the-scenes scary details about working with the dinosaurs. And then we actually got him scheduled today, Craig Ferrand. Yes, the man and his experience of many years of being managing editor of, I believe, a Press and Guide locally, all of his years of experience in the news, and some of the great columns that we haven't shared with you because they're not short enough for fitting a lot of stories into this hour here on the Journal. But he's going to help us try to analyze the outcome of the November 4th election in the local area and maybe the state. So we're going to get the sage opinions of someone other than yours truly. John Conroy will be back and join us again for that show. But Craig Ferrand will be with us, the one of the editorial columnists for, and it's called Op-Ed because he says what he wants to say, for the local Press and Guide newspaper. So we're looking forward to that election review and recap. And in some cases, we come up with the numbers, the actual numbers for local races, before you hear them anywhere else or before you see them anywhere else in the papers even. So happy to do that for you. That's going to be a big show November 7th here on the new WHFR Journal. Well, back to other stories in the news. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, just about a little bit less than 10 minutes now, is, of course, Highway 61 with Joanne. And she will be coming in for 4 big hours of the latest and best in blues music, and especially, of course, an emphasis on local area blues artists. Okay, I have to comment here as a car guy. Yes, I should do a car show, but it's hard to do car shows on the radio. I could play some sounds of, you know, automotive engines revving or brakes squealing, I guess, but it's kind of hard to do an effective show. Although those guys on public radio, Car Talk, they were telling you how to repair your cars and buy new cars for years. I just don't have the comedy talent that they had. Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, they used to call themselves. That's not their real names, of course. And they're not doing the show anymore, I don't believe. But anyway, I have to talk about the anti-Tesla so-called law that's been passed here in Michigan. I even called the governor's office myself. When was the last time you called the governor? Well, I didn't get to talk to him, but I got to talk to, I think, his secretary. And it didn't do any good, of course, because I guess I started out by saying, I'm just an average person, but, well, if you're just an average person, heck with what you believe. If you're not the Automotive Dealer Association of Michigan or whatever their name is, then you're nobody here. If you're not General Motors, you're nobody on this. Because apparently GM, and this is so contradictory, told the governor, sign this bill. It's good, Bill, because it protects us from those outside direct factory sales from other automakers, like Tesla. See, Tesla can't sell in the state directly to people. However, you can, if you really want to buy a Tesla, they're about $70,000 or more right now for the current Model S. And it's not a commercial, but I'm just saying if you wanted to, you can go online to their website. You can buy one. When it's ready, it'll come to the closest distribution point to us is Columbus, Ohio. And you'll have to drive down there or get a bus or something and pick the car up down there. Apparently, there's about 50 Teslas in Michigan right now. And it's totally legal to license them and drive them in Michigan. But you can't buy them here. You have to have a franchise dealer system. Well, let me give you some background on this, folks. What was wrong? What's wrong with the car buying situation for all these years? GM, Ford, Chrysler, they did research on this 20, 30 years ago when they had this big competition from Japan. And of course, they have franchise dealers in Michigan. Michigan even has already a law saying you have to be sold through a franchise dealer. But there were ways around that law, and it's been tightened up so that Tesla can't even have a so-called gallery, that is, bring their cars into, say, a shopping center, put them on display. You don't buy it there, but there's salespeople that can, or information people that can talk to you about it. That can't happen in Michigan. And so you might say, well, why don't they just come up with why don't they sell franchises? Well, then they could be in every state. Yeah, well, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, 10, 20 years ago, all came to the same conclusion. The worst part for people that want to buy a car is the dealer experience. Dealing with a dealer. Dealing with their salespeople. And believe me, I realize now, I've been buying cars. Mm-hmm. Yep. On my own for 47 years. And sometimes more than a couple in 1 year, one after the other. I'm a serial monogamist when it comes to car buying. I like new cars, often lease them because I don't drive much, but I love having a new car. And it's just a hobby. So you say, well, that's kind of expensive to do it that way. But I love driving cars that drive well. Okay, you can call them sports cars or touring cars. I love cars that handle. Not so much for that fast acceleration, but corner and brake. That's all safety stuff. Talked about this before on some of our auto show episodes around the time of the Detroit Auto Show, as I continue to call it, every February, January, February, whatever. And I have to say, out of all the 20-some experiences, and I'm not an easy customer, I'm always looking at 3-4 different brands of cars and go to 3 or 4 different dealers for each brand, sometimes driving 50, 60 miles. And all I really want is to be treated honestly and professionally, with not all the flim-flam, the misinformation, the double dealing, or wait a while, let me check with my manager about what we can do. Okay? So I bought a lot of foreign cars because a lot of those dealerships have really good salesperson experiences. And they have only one price. So yeah, there you can't hassle. You pay that price. And that's it. So they can usually treat you a lot better when this is the price. This is the only price. We're the closest dealer to you. Why would you don't need to go anywhere else. But they still need to treat you like a human being, right? And so only once or twice out of 22 car buying experiences, which are always major deals for me and never easy because I'm not going to take the first thing and I'm not going to take a bad deal, and I'm not going to be made fun of by dealers because I know so much, because I'm smart. Yes, yes, I've been ridiculed by many dealerships, by managers at dealerships, as well as salespeople. And I said, this is true. GM, Ford, and Chrysler have done research. The worst part of the car buying experience, the reason that their cars don't sell better, is because the dealerships are not under their control. They don't control the dealers. They'd love to. They'd love to control them. They would love to, in spite of what GM just said, in endorsing this anti-Tesla bill. It's all just politics, folks. It's nothing to do with reality. If they could all become direct-to-you dealerships and get rid of the franchise people in between that only cause trouble. Yes, you're going to need dealer. You're going to need factory-owned dealers all around. Of course you will, and because they got to do the service. They'll take your order. They'll answer your questions in person. Of course. But they don't have to be owned by somebody else. That's where the extra profit comes in, the extra loss, the extra waste. And to have them all competing against one another, Tesla can offer so much better cars at so much less price because there's no middleman. Okay? So when Governor Snyder, even after he signed this in place, said, you know, I'd like the legislature, and I can't do a Governor Snyder impersonation, to maybe look at this whole buying experience and, you know, maybe do something about it. They're not going to. That's just a way to console the people that called your office like myself and said, look, there's factory stores all across Michigan that are not franchise factory stores. They're run by the factories. Okay, they sell shoes, they sell sweaters, whatever they are. They're factory stores. But oh no, cars, they have to go through a local dealer. There's no advantage, and it's been proven that dealerships cause more trouble for the car maker and for you, the customer, in terms of cost and personal hassle, psychological trauma, than if it went directly, cleanly from the car maker directly to you. And I apologize to any dealers who are honest and nice and kind and never lie. I haven't met any of them. And I've gone to several dealers here in Dearborn. I always go to several Ford dealers in Dearborn. Never been able to get finalized into a deal here. Oh, okay, once I bought a Taurus show, okay, early 90s. Boy, that was a negotiation. I don't want to have to go into that. That's a long story. It's 2:00, and it's time to get on with The Best in the Blues with Joanne Kay. I'm just going to run down some details here while she's coming in and getting settled for the show. Okay, a couple things coming up. First of all, tonight there's a benefit for Dearborn Animal Shelter at Dearborn Inn. Oh, it's fancy. If you've got $175 a person, it's a fancy night. Debbie Dingell, John Dingell, Mayor O'Reilly, all kinds of fancy people will be there. And you can dress up in formal clothes and have a wild time. I bet there's still tickets available at $175 a person. But it's a good cause. Got to get that new animal shelter going. Tomorrow evening, a benefit for Henry Ford's own radio station, us, WHFR. We're doing a dance music, techno music, if you will, house mix party at the Oakwood Bar and Grill down there at Oakwood and Southfield Expressway. And that's tomorrow night. Starts at 8:00. The music does, goes till 2:00. And a lot of us are going to be there. It does represent 10 years for Brandon McKay, who calls himself on the air, DJ Bam, who has been on Thursday nights now for